Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the TakeCast. My name is Davis Matic. You can find me on Twitter at Davis Matic. In this episode of the show, I am joined by Kevin Cole in a little crossover with the What Would Sashi Do podcast. Kevin Cole is an employee of RotoGrinders and is the owner of PredictiveFootball.com. And I appeared on his podcast, What Would Sashi Do? And after we recorded that episode, we hopped on over to the TakeCast and did a little bit of predictive analytics talk. We talked about some things going on in the National Basketball Association because Kevin is a really sharp guy and has some really interesting thoughts on the playoff series between the Warriors and the Rockets and the future of the game. We talked about some NFL draft fallout. I tried to get Kevin to do his version of a hot take at the end of the episode. You guys will probably enjoy that. Of course, if you want to support the show, you can always leave a rating and review on iTunes. That is very appreciated. And we are, of course, sponsored by DailyRoto.com, the best projections and tools in the industry. You can get 10% off of the Elite Package at DailyRoto.com using the promo code RORY. We are also sponsored by RotoExperts.com with the NFL 365 package. You get a year-round access to our projections, rankings, and best ball tools, as well as premium paid articles using the promo code MATTEK, M-A-T-T-E-K. And now let's get into the episode. All right, everyone, in a brilliant stroke of marketing, I realized after coming on Kevin Cole's great What Would Sashi Do podcast, we should just do a crossover. So, Kevin Cole, welcome back to the podcast, my friend.
It's good to be back, yeah. Time, guess, which is basically like you need to fill someone else to jump in, so I'm willing to do that.
Yeah, there we go. So, the first question that I want to ask you is, of course, relating to the title of your podcast, would Sashi be proud of what John Dorsey has done with the Browns? Do you think that the 2019 Browns are Sashi's vision played out?
I don't think it's fully Sashi's vision. I've become more of a fan of what I've seen Chris Ballar doing in Indianapolis. And there are two main components of why I think what he's done is more interesting. Number one is always looking towards the future. I mean, that's something where I can't see Sashi at any point in time saying we want to be negative as far as draft capital versus what you would expect going forward. And, you know, the Browns did that this year. Now, it was part of that was trading for Odell Beckham, which I do think was a great move, of course. And I think that's something that was
I don't know if Sashi would have done that, I'll be honest. I think maybe he would not have.
It's possible that he wouldn't have. I'm not saying 100% that he would have. And I also think the overwhelming consensus that it's a good trade is probably a little overconfident in that just because you don't know what's going to happen with one particular player. But I do think that he probably would have done it. But aside from that, you know, Dorsey was looking to potentially trade up in this draft. I think it could have happened. He did trade up at least slightly in the second round to go get Greedy Williams, where, you know, a lot of people like that pick, but at the same time, you know, just sit around and wait. There'll be another cornerback that'll be available as you're sitting there. So he's gone negative, whereas Chris Ballard is continuing to pile up future picks. When you get those future first and second round picks, Ballard got another second round pick. Those are the best future picks to get because the variance is so high of the value, whether or not the team does poorly the next year. And they got the pick from the Washington Redskins. So that could end up being a very, very high second round pick. So I like that. And then also, you know, the Browns right now are over the 2019 salary cap pretty significantly, even if you don't count dead money this year, which is okay because they had so much rollover cap, but still you're building now from a foundation that's over the cap. So going forward, when you sign Baker Mayfield, when you sign Myles Garrett, when you sign Denzel Ward, all these different guys to long-term deals, you're really looking at a team that could be its best incarnation this coming year. And we'll see how similar situations with the Rams and others play out in subsequent years where you've invested so much up front for this quote-unquote rookie quarterback contract window. I think I'd prefer if you lessen your chances of winning slightly this year and next year to extend that window and extend the amount of capital that you have to play with in those years.
So the one pushback I would have to that is, does the NFL salary cap even really matter? Like how much does it really, because it seems like maybe it doesn't at all.
I think it does. I think people conflate these two ideas of the salary cap doesn't matter and you can structure contracts to always fit in one player if you need to, right? So if you right. need to fit in X player and you don't have any salary cap, you can always find a way of doing that. And the way you do that is there's so many different players who don't have guaranteed money left, or it isn't fully guaranteed, of course. You can cut them. So that's one way of getting in. Another way you get them in is you give them this very large upfront signing bonus. You amortize that cost and of that guarantee over a number of years, and you barely pay them anything up front, which is what you've seen with lots of different contracts. Like Aaron Rodgers' deal was hugely like that. Like you see all the time where cap hits go down when they're re-signing players to these huge deals. And that's the reason why. The problem is eventually you do have to pay up, or you have to restructure these things over and over again. And it's not a death knell. I mean, no one's dead because of it, but it certainly constricts what you can do in future years. And then if you suffer a few injuries, you can have some problems.
Yeah, I think all of that makes sense. I do think that this is not Sashi's vision. I agree with that. But I actually think there's a little bit to the idea, not that Sashi would fall victim to this, but that we've seen other teams in other leagues have trouble for, specifically Danny Ainge, is at what point do you stop accruing assets and go for it? So the 76ers went for it, and I think that they did it poorly. But what Danny Ainge did is Danny never went for it, and his string of assets is almost gone.
Yeah, I mean, I think basketball, you can actually go for it a little bit more because you can be more certain.
Well, one transaction can change it in NBA. That can't happen in the NFL.
I mean, you can be more certain of superstar talent, I think. So
yeah.
I think a lot of people, I would disagree a little bit with the Sixers and whether or not they're doing the right things or not. I think a lot of people, that there are people who are anti-process who have said, this is the antithesis of the process, what you saw Brand do, bringing in Tobias Harris and Jimmy Butler before that. But if you look at what Daryl Morey has been doing in Houston, he's a guy who was, you know, Hinkie's mentor in a lot of ways. He came into a very different situation. He came into a situation that didn't require a tank. And he basically went all in on Chris Paul. And then he was supposedly looking to trade four first round picks for Jimmy Butler. So he was willing to continue to go more and more further in. And I think in basketball, you can be more certain that the talent that you're acquiring and that you're paying a ton of money for, you're getting value for. Whereas in the NFL, outside of the quarterback position, if you're going to pay big money to any player, the chance that you're going to get that or higher value for them is a 50-50 proposition at best. And I think that's what's very different. Whereas in the NBA, these guys, you can't pay them enough money if they're true superstars.
Right, yeah. I mean, a true max contract doesn't exist for LeBron James or Kevin Durant or whatever. Continuing on this trend, do you agree with the now popular take that super math ball has made the Rockets unwatchable? Kirk Goldsberry has a book coming out, Sprawl Ball Now, where he talks about moving the three-point line back or making the lane narrower to sort of bring back the big man, basically. Do you agree with these takes?
I don't think the math take and the three-pointer thing necessarily equals how Houston's style of play is. I mean, you've seen across the league an increase in three-pointers over time, and you've also seen an increase in popularity of the sport over time. I think what's unique about Houston is that James Harden is just – he's hacked the system, essentially, and what he's able to do as an isolation player. I mean, you don't see other teams doing this, right? You don't see other teams just going heavy ISO with one particular player and everyone standing around. I mean, teams like the Warriors, who've been the most successful, have a lot of movement. They're not even necessarily throwing up as many threes. I mean, the Bucks are throwing up a ton of threes, so they're bringing into it, but they're also not doing what James Harden is doing. I think Harden is just a unique player. He's added so much to his game, and he's so good at making these decisions that he does the improbable, which is making isolation basketball a very effective play. So I guess you could say it is math in that they're crunching the numbers and figuring out how effective it is for Harden to do this. But I don't think it's something that other teams are going to be able to replicate because James Harden is so unique and so good at what he does.
I actually just want, like, for one season, I want Kevin Durant to go to a team, and we'll probably see this next year, actually, when Kevin Durant goes to the Knicks. But I want Durant to play Harden ball, where he just every trip down, the first option on offense is getting him a three or getting him a drive to the basket. Because I seriously think he could. I think Kevin Durant, if he played in the Harden role, I think he could score 42 points a game.
I definitely think he'd score 42 points a game. Now, whether or not I don't think he'd be better than James Harden in that role, only because I think James Harden's passing and decision making and vision.
I don't know if he'd draw the same fouls either.
Yeah, well, it's weird. Everyone trashes Harden for the fact that he's seeking out these fouls, and I agree. You know, he's definitely doing it. There's no doubt about it. But it's not easy to score. And be cognizant of what's going on where you're drawing fouls at the same time. It's like he's kind of playing to score and he's playing to draw a foul at the same time. And I think a lot of times when players don't do it, when they let a guy fly by rather than jump into him, it's not because they're so altruistic and they don't feel like that's the best way of playing the game, but it's just, you know, they're concentrated on making the shot and they're not, and you have to kind of multitask and think about what's the best way to maximize the points on the possession versus the best way to maximize making the shot. And I mean, I just think Harden's an incredible processor for everything he can process as far as where the guys are on the court, the different reactions of the defense, where the ball should go. He makes good decisions so often that I'm not sure even Kevin Durant could do that. Kevin Durant could score. There's no doubt about that, but I don't know if he could distribute the ball in the same way with the right decision.
I think you're definitely right, actually. Yeah, he's not near as good of a passer, and his decision would be to shoot most of the time, I think, probably. If they were running that offense around Durant, it would be him shooting, you know, 30-ish times a game or using 30 shooting possessions per game.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he's, you know, there's no getting around the fact that Durant is the dominant player on that team. So he's the dominant player on the best team. They seem to be playing their best when he's playing his best. So yeah, obviously we've seen the stuff with Steph Curry recently and what's going on. I was more of a Curry apologist, but I could see both ways on whether or not you really want to say it's him or it's someone else. I mean, Durant's going to be really interesting. I just can't wait for him to get off of that team, honestly, so I can see how the Warriors can perform without him. Cause I think they might go back to being this insanely dominant regular season team, and then everything will matter in the playoffs. And that's when things will get really interesting.
So this was the next question I have is, first of all, do you think that this Warriors team is Durant's team now? Like, do you think that they go as he goes, sort of?
I don't think you can argue anything else at this point. Not in the playoffs, at least. It's just in the playoffs, that's the way it works. It's kind of surprising to me, honestly. I mean, I know people laud Curry for his, you know, humility and allowing things to play off the way that they do, but he really has almost accepted the backseat role. I mean, Kerr has gone out of his way to say how Kevin Durant's the best player on the team and maybe the best player in the NBA, which I thought was a little surprising because it seemed
they've kowtowed to Curry for so long.
I mean, I guess Curry was unanimous MVP. I mean, remember before the season that Durant got there, you know, he was the unanimous MVP. He was the guy. They won the 73 games, everything else. So it's kind of strange to see him come off of that. There's definitely something about playoff basketball, though, where when you have to go get your shot, Kevin Durant's in a much better position to do that than someone like Steph Curry.
Yeah, I think that Kevin Durant, this is the first time I've ever been able to say this with a straight face and not being a homer when he was in Oklahoma City. I think that Durant is the best player in basketball now. I think that now that LeBron is not the best player, when you look at everything, like scoring efficiency, defense, rebounding, I think Durant is, he's like a hair better than Kawhi and definitely better than Giannis.
Yeah, the one thing that I think gets undervalued is the creation aspect outside of scoring generally. So I think minus that, Durant is definitely the best. It'll be interesting to see how he performs. Let's say he comes to the Knicks. I guess they're talking about Kyrie maybe coming there too. So that complicates things a little bit because both of those guys need the ball in their hands. But, you know, if he comes to a team where he doesn't have guys, you know, just these other guys around him, it'll be interesting to see whether it just becomes such a dominant Durant show that the results suffer a bit based upon that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that those are all pretty fair points. And I still think that I don't even know if we really have a good mathematical way to account for Curry's gravity other than on-off, which doesn't always work because a lot of the times when Curry's off, Durant is on, so they're staggered. So, like, the on-off numbers are sort of unfair to Curry because when he's not on the court, there are some other really amazing players on the court. So I think that I don't remember who tweeted this, but if someone was like, look, you could take one player,
you only have five guys to win one playoff game. I still think Curry might actually be the top pick because of the, like, you can just put him with four other complete randos, you know, four league average guys at every other position, and you probably do the best with him because his spacing makes it easier for everyone else to do their job.
Yeah, there's an analyst. He doesn't have that big of a following on Twitter, this guy Ben Taylor, but he wrote this. He has a website, Back Picks, and he does YouTube videos and other stuff where he goes over a bunch of different ways of looking at creation and other things. He had something where I believe the term he uses is called scalability, and the term is meant that how much when you put other great players around this player, how much does this either detract from their game, or do they detract from other people's games? So I feel like Durant's a guy where he doesn't scale as well as Curry does. So if you put Durant on a team, he's going to take some numbers away from other players. Whereas if you put Curry on there, you know, he's going to lose some of his own numbers, but the effect that he has just being out there and the gravity on the court, like, he scales really well. He can play with other really great scorers and not necessarily lose the value that he has just because of what he does with gravity out there. I mean, it's weird. Like, Curry's a weird guy because if you look at his numbers, especially in the regular season, it's tougher to point out in the playoffs, but in the regular season, the Warriors have been significantly better without Durant with Curry then vice versa. Like it's not even close. They're basically still a 70, you know, I guess high 60, 70 win team with Curry and without Durant. And then the opposite is more like a 50 something win team. But then in the playoffs, everything switches around. So it's really difficult to figure all those different things out. But I think there are plus minus types of measures that point to Curry really having that effect.
Yeah, Nate Duncan and Danny LaRue talk about scalability a lot on their podcast, the Dunked On NBA Show, which if you guys are listening to this and you guys really like NBA podcasts, I would recommend that. That's the most minutia you can get in like almost any sports podcast. But they've made the point that Klay Thompson is like the most scalable player in the NBA. Like, name a team where Klay Thompson would be a bad fit. You can't, because his spacing and his shooting just makes him fit in literally anywhere. And he's good on defense. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, defense is always scalable, right? There's no, unless the only time a defense isn't scalable is like a big man who can control the paint. So you don't really need two of those guys. Like, if you have two bigs who can't guard the pick and roll, who can't switch but can control the paint, then that's not very scalable. But if you have a wing who can switch, then they're completely scalable on defense also.
Yeah, I think all of that is definitely true. All right, transitioning back to football, this is a really interesting question to me. How many NFL teams do you think have a legitimately bad quarterback? A quarterback, like, basically you would say was incapable of winning a playoff game. A Colt McCoy caliber starting quarterback. I think we could be at an all-time low.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I'm looking across and, you know, can't win a playoff game is a very low bar, but even if you set some sort of probability threshold on there,
six adjusted yards per attempt or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost impossible to find anyone that fits into that category. I mean, I guess you could say the Giants with Eli, I'm not sure if he's quite there, but even Eli,
they're the only team I went through and I looked, and I think they're the only team I would say that you think that they have a bad quarterback situation. So Cincinnati, there's another one you could mention, but they drafted Ryan Finley, who people think is, you know, decent. Denver has Drew Lock, who some people, you know, what do you think of Drew Lock actually?
I'm of the opinion when you see those guys taken, it smells like a
desperation.
Like a Deshaun Kizer type of pick. You know, everyone passed on him. He has tools. We'll see if he can put things together. So quite often those picks just don't work. I mean, second round quarterback success rates, especially beyond the first few picks in the second round, are really, really low. So some of that may just be bias against those guys and playing time and things like that. But it's kind of tough. But I agree. I think, you know, maybe I think Mariota and the Titans can win a playoff game, but only because the defense plays really well. I don't know if he could win a game where the defense is not playing well at all. So he might be another guy where I feel like the ceiling limited type of quarterback.
So let's actually talk a little bit more in depth about Marcus Mariota, because Marcus Mariota is a fascinating player if you like have watched a lot of football in your life. So he was, I mean, he was one of the best quarterback prospects. He was sort of Kyler-esque, actually, as a quarterback prospect, because he was so dominant in college. Like, I think, do you watch college football at all?
I watch it for quarterback play mostly. So yeah, no, I definitely watched some of it that year because that was the Jameis year also. So there were some big quarterbacks coming up.
So Mariota in college, he started for three seasons. He started as a true freshman. He threw 14 interceptions total in college. He averaged 9.1, 10.6, and 11.5 adjusted yards per attempt, threw at least 30 touchdowns every single year, ran for at least 700 yards every year, and his final season at Oregon, he was responsible for over 60 offensive touchdowns. So, like, maybe there's some revisionist history about him as a quarterback prospect, but I don't think there's any way to say he wasn't one of the better quarterback prospects we've ever seen. And it's never shown up in the NFL other than his second season. And I don't know, do you think that he still has that second season form?
I'm not sure. I mean, we've seen the injuries. I mean, the one concerning thing about him that maybe wasn't recognized at the time, and this could just be total hindsight bias now that I'm looking at it, is that he's pretty tall. I think he's 6'4".
Yeah.
But he's like pretty thin. He was only, I think, 210 pounds, something like that. So he's not really a well-built guy. And there are a lot of studies that have pointed to the fact that weight for quarterback actually ends up being more significant than height. There's this concentration on height, but guys who are short, but if they're pretty stocky, I mean, like someone like Baker Mayfield is a pretty stocky guy, even though he wasn't that big. You could say the same of Russell Wilson for sure. I mean, Murray, maybe. I don't know. I think Murray is pretty big, at least lower half pretty big. So, you know, Mariota's a pretty thin guy, and he hasn't held up well because of that. So I'm not sure in the NFL, you may need to have like a certain BMI type of threshold in order to survive also.
Yeah, and I mean, or if you don't have that threshold, you like have to be pretty good at avoiding hits, and I don't think Mariota has ever learned that skill. Like, man, I'm looking at his career numbers now, and they're really bad. Mariota he's been good once, and that was it. But
yeah,
like,
I mean, he was good. He was pretty good to start his career. Everyone was very positive about him. Because it's interesting.
I mean, his rookie year was better than Darnold's rookie year.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I mean, someone was talking recently about how every year, even if a team already has a quarterback, well, they were pushing back against the Kyler Murray thing, and they were saying every year, even if a team already has a quarterback, they pretend to be interested in the quarterbacks because, you know, drive up interest on trading the pick, which I always thought that was kind of a nonsense idea. But, you know, the Titans had the number one pick the year after Mariota's rookie year, but there wasn't like there was any talk of taking Carson Wentz or Jared Goff, despite the fact that they were seen as being great prospects. I mean, everyone was all in on Mariota because he looked good that year.
Right.
And things have just not gone well since. That's for sure.
Yeah. And I don't know. Like, so if you were the Titans and they trade for Ryan Tannehill, what do you do? Has Mariota signed his extension yet?
Well, he's on his fifth year option.
Right. So they haven't given him a mega deal yet.
No, they have not given him a deal. So that's not out. That's not out.
If you're the Tennessee Titans decision making, do you give Mariota the Blake Bortles extension or whatever? Do you give him the bigger contract?
No, I don't think so. But it's tough to say. You know, one of the things that now that we know the price of it too, I would have been more interested in it. But in the offseason when I was looking through all the different teams for a team that could be interested in trading for Josh Rosen, the Titans jumped out at me as a team that not a lot of people were thinking about, where, you know, if Mariota does not work out, right, you have to re-sign him after this year or let him go. Then you're going to have to draft a rookie. Then you're going to have to not have a top pick because you're going to be somewhat decent this year because you have a good team around Mariota. Then you're going to have a year where you stink, then you may have to have another year to get the quarterback. I mean, it could be a 3-4 year search for a quarterback. So you might feel very compelled to re-sign Mariota, even if he's not good. Whereas if they would have gotten Rosen, I felt like he was at least another option that they could have. They could let Mariota go. They could even maybe bring him in mid-season just to have that optionality for a team that was good around there. So I was hoping they were going to do something like that because it's going to be a very tough decision if you have no backup plan for Marcus Mariota when he's on his fifth year option this year.
Well, they have a backup plan now. Like, I don't know. I mean, how different is Ryan Tannehill of a player than Mariota is at this point? I don't know if they're that much different.
Well, he's like if you had Marcus Mariota and you gave him another however many years, Tannehill. I mean, Tannehill's like how old is Ryan Tannehill?
Ryan Tannehill is 30 years old.
Okay, so Tannehill has been the most like mediocre quarterback, and you don't like to say that anyone has no chance of breaking out, but Ryan Tannehill has been the breakout candidate for at least like five out of the first, you know, 6 years that he was playing in the NFL. People were pegging him as a breakout. It just never happened. So I think if you can be certain of anyone just giving you mediocre stats going forward, it would be someone like Tannehill. So that's why I was hoping with Rosen they could spend, I mean, they would have spent their second round pick to get Josh Rosen. I feel like that would have been a decent deal for them to have someone like that there. But, you know, that's obviously teams were not looking to spend any capital on a quarterback if they felt like they were in a playoff push at this point in time.
You could argue Jacksonville, I guess, would be a team that doesn't have a great quarterback situation. They have Cody Kessler, Nick Foles, and Gardner Minshew. But I don't know. Jacksonville probably feels happy with Nick Foles, right?
No, I think they have to. I mean, he's, you know, Super Bowl champion Nick Foles. So we'll see what ends up happening there. I mean, this is just another move that's added to the colossal mistake of drafting Leonard Fournette and not taking a quarterback with that pick. And I know a lot of people might even say this is hindsight, but I was definitely banging that drum pretty hard at that point in time. I mean, ever since then, they just had a series of moves to try to put Band-Aids over all the different problems that have come out with quarterbacks since then. And this Nick Foles is the latest one where it's going to potentially set them back another couple of years before they can refresh and figure out who their quarterback is going to be.
Leonard Fournette is my favorite player taking over another player. So Fournette instead of Mahomes is my new favorite Jacksonville taking a punter over Russell Wilson. That's like my new favorite meme to talk about how bad teams are at drafting.
I mean, it doesn't get any worse. Like literally, it doesn't get any worse.
Like, Leonard Fournette is, like, not only a zero, he's, like, an outright negative because he convinces your coach to call worse plays.
I mean, it all started with Coughlin. Like, Coughlin, like, they brought this guy back, and ever since then, it's just been all downhill. And if you think about it, you know, it wasn't like Bortles had that one okay year after they took Fournette, and then they extended him after that. So it wasn't like Bortles was even coming off of that strong of a year. He had a poor rookie year. He had an okay second year, all garbage time type of stuff. He had another like pretty poor third year, and then that's when they took Fournette, and then he came back and did okay in his fourth year, and they extended him. So there were really no signs that say drafting a early down thumper running back was the way to go. But you know, these guys are the experts, I guess.
So okay, the one other team you could maybe argue would have a bad quarterback situation would be the Oakland Raiders. And I just went through all 32 teams while we were here. And I would say the Raiders, the Titans, and the Jaguars would be the only teams that you would even want to argue. But Washington has Keenum and Haskins. You know, that's a fine quarterback room. Tampa Bay is fine. San Francisco has multiple guys who are fine. And the Giants obviously have a bad quarterback situation.
Yeah, I mean, the league has changed quite a bit. I think there is a almost one-to-one correlation between quarterback quality and the breadth of good quarterbacks throughout the league and how popular the league is. I mean, remember when everyone was wringing their hands a couple of years ago about NFL ratings, things like that. Now you got so many great names, so many great quarterbacks that have filled these spots. You know, Mahomes, Watson, Wentz, Mayfield, Darnold, all these guys across the board. This is probably the healthiest we've seen the position for a pretty long time.
Yeah. All right, final question. Let's just give a grade to the Cardinals' handling of the Rosen ordeal all the way from, not from trading up, so let's go from basically week one, 2018, till hiring Cliff Kingsbury to now, how do you think that the GM and the organization handled the whole ordeal of drafting a rookie quarterback, realizing he wasn't that good, getting the number one pick, seeing that there was a better quarterback there?
So, I'm sorry, are we including the decision to draft him as part of this or
no? No. So we're taking, because I think the decision to trade up for him at this point is like a D. So we're just going to leave that there. So we're going to go from, we're divorcing it from actually selecting him to week one, 2018, watching him play for 16 weeks, watching Kyler play and realizing you were going to move on.
Yeah. I mean, they didn't put, first of all, he wasn't put in a good enough situation to truly evaluate him. Right. So I guess that's, but that, those are also decisions that were made in that offseason with bringing in Mike McCoy and not bringing in any receivers or anything else to really help him there. But I feel like once that's like your perfect sunk cost sort of thing with Rosen. So I think moving on from was fine. I know that they've gotten a lot of criticism for not shopping him early. Yeah, I mean, I think ideally you'd want to squeeze out a little bit more draft capital if possible in the trade. But the problem is exactly what we just talked about, which is the quarterback needy teams. There aren't a lot of them, right? So if the Dolphins didn't make a play for him, who else is going to make a play for him? And to get someone, I don't think you're going to get someone to commit before the draft because teams like Washington are going to want to sit around and see who is available to them when they're picking. So I'm not sure if they really handled that poorly. I'd say that the one mistake that they made and they end up looking bad going back on it is what, when Kingsbury said, Josh Rosen is our guy. I actually don't mind that. That's fine. But then, because he never said he will be our guy, he said, is our guy. So I feel like that was okay and not being deceitful. But don't do the social media blast. Don't do the owner like going on there and doing all that stuff. Like, just continue saying that. Just continue saying Josh Rosen is our guy. Don't say for now. Just keep on saying Josh Rosen is our guy. And then you don't kind of look foolish through that whole process. But I think they made the right move. But Kingsbury gave them cover to make that move. I don't think there's any chance they make that move if they don't bring in a new coach who can assure them that he really wants this player and can make a big change with Kyler Murray.
So I give the decision to move on from Rosen an A+, because I do think Kyler is sort of like the unicorn quarterback prospect. And I feel very certain saying Kyler Murray is going to be a top 15 NFL quarterback in his career. I don't feel certain at all saying that about Josh Rosen. I give the return that they got and the way that they handled it like a B-. I think that the social media stuff and only getting a second for him kind of sucks. Though, I guess, to your point, I mean, how much of a market was there out there for quarterbacks? If the Giants weren't going to bite, I don't know who you could have gotten, I guess, to give you more. But and I think that it does suck for Rosen that he's going to get to watch Kyler play with all these weapons when he had to throw to Trent Sherfield.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's possible that if you started the process earlier, then there are teams, like I mentioned the Titans before, but that's probably unrealistic that they would look to pony something up. But there, I guess there is, maybe you could sell some other teams who weren't immediately quarterback needy that there are bids out there. Like the Dolphins are interested, so therefore maybe you can give up a little bit more. So they couldn't really play one team off of another. But at best, I think they're moving up 10, 15 spots. I don't think you're moving up much further than that.
Yeah, and I guess the one thing you could say about starting it earlier was if you started early enough, teams would probably treat Josh Rosen like they're like put him on their draft board, basically, like include trading your whatever pick as, you know, trading up for whatever rookie you wanted this year. Because I think maybe Oakland would have given up a first for Rosen. I could see Gruden doing that, and I didn't hear that talked about in the process at all.
Yeah, that was not really talked about at all. I guess they're willing to stick with Carr, even though...
Doesn't that feel weird? Like, all the changes they've made to this team, they're adding Jacobs, they add Brown, they add Williams, they kind of revamp the defense a little bit. Like, doesn't it just feel really bizarre for them to just be like, nope, Derek's our guy?
Well, you know, his contract isn't egregious where it is. They have an out, I think, to get out of there. I mean, maybe they're going to say, one more year type of situation. He did have a good year, although he's only, well, good meaning like top half. He's only had like one top half year in his career a couple of years ago. So, I mean, I think they're just going with all of that. And then they were in a bad spot at four. There was nothing that they could really do to go either way. I mean, I guess if they wanted to say someone like Haskins, although I'm not really that high on immobile guys like Haskins anyway. So they're kind of in a bad spot because they're kind of stuck. I think the best move they could have done is maybe roll some of that capital forward into next year. And then if you're really bad, make a play on a quarterback in 2020. Because it was kind of tough to figure out what they were going to do this year.
Yeah, I think that that more or less makes sense. I do think that the Raiders have a plan. I'm pretty low on that team, and I think the market expects them to be better.
No, I definitely don't think they have a plan, but you never know in the NFL what ends up happening. I mean, they...
Right.
I think they're like the two teams that have been so thoroughly trashed, which are the Raiders and the Giants, could both be better than people expect this year. So it could be one of those situations where expectations are just really, really low on those teams. And they have enough talent there where in the NFL, you know, anything can happen. But the AFC West is also not a very friendly division. So I think the Raiders are working uphill probably even more than the Giants are.
Yeah, I mean, they play in a much, like, they play in the division right with the best player in the NFL. So that's gonna swing things for a while. All right, before we get out of here, we talked about the art of the take on your podcast. So I would like to get at least one scorched earth, hot fire 2019 fantasy football take from you. Do you have one for me?
Scorched earth, hot fire. I mean, oh God, maybe I guess we already talked about Gurley also on my podcast. So he was a guy where I remember the night before the Super Bowl, I was fooling around with Evan Silva and Rich Rebar and these other guys that were at the Roto Grinders Super Bowl party, and I was just like banging the table about how Gurley must be injured and wasn't gonna play that much. So I guess that would have been my scorching take, but now I feel like everyone has jumped on the Gurley is injured and will never be any good bandwagon. So I gotta think of something else. Give me one second to think here about.
Well, I'll give you mine. And okay, mine is that after watching the NFL draft and seeing what the Chiefs did, I think it's pretty clear that they think Damian Williams is good enough to play for them for this year, and Damian Williams is going to be an RB1 in fantasy.
That's an interesting one. Yeah, I don't know if you heard, but there was Evan Silva was doing a podcast where he had Nelson Souza, I want to say is his name. He's one of these high stakes guys. And he said the exact opposite. He was pointing to these guys who jump out of nowhere to be really strong, like guys who were basically free agents the year before, who were then being drafted high as being some of the riskiest guys. I mean, I've always been a Damian Williams truther, going back to when he was with Miami. So I'm not going to go against anyone who wants to play him up, because I think he'll be really strong this year. I got to think of something here. Let me think for a second.
I can do another one. Juju Smith-Schuster should go ahead of all the other wide receivers, and I don't think that you're dumb for taking him at like 103. I would defend taking Juju Smith-Schuster as high as that.
Yeah, you know, that's another thing that that JJ Zacharyson, he was talking about. I could project that. I could definitely see that one going forward. I guess my take would be, I mean, it's weird to see Zeke getting pumped up again, being near the top. I think he might even be the first running back being taken in a lot of drafts. So I'm going to just go anti here. So I'm going to go anti Zeke this year, because I think the Cowboys are going to implode a little bit, especially on offense this year. So I'll just say that Zeke will be one of the biggest busts at the front end of the draft, and it won't even be an injury concern. I just feel like that offense is going to be a lot worse than what people think this year, because that boost they got at the end of the year with Amari Cooper, I just don't see that continuing this year. And it was based on a lot of like low probability stuff that they were getting forward. So that would be my take, is that Zeke is going to be overdrafted in the first round.
And they drafted Tony Pollard to kind of be in that hybrid spell role, and they signed Mike Weber as an undrafted free agent. I can get on board with this take, with them being worse on offense and him having just less work overall. I can co-sign.
It's kind of what everyone thought last year, where I thought that concern was a little bit overhyped, but I just don't think their offense is that good, especially some of the stuff that we're going to see with the offensive line. So we'll see what ends up happening. I guess Jason Witten's back, so you never know.
There we go. All right, everyone. Kevin Cole, make sure to listen to the What Would Sashi Do podcast that will be out at the time that you are listening to this.